Oh, the best beer in the world is made in America. There's no question about it. There's more creativity and more integrity and more variety in America than the rest of the world combined. My name is Fritz Maytag, and I'm the owner of Anchor Brewing Company. I call myself president and brewmaster, or owner and brewmaster. I used to hang out at the old spaghetti factory. In fact, I went there long before I knew anything about the brewery in the summer of 57. That's when I first met the owner, Fred Koo. I used to hang out there. It was the equivalent of an Englishman's local, the pub that you go to every evening, maybe before, after dinner and before bed, you go down and have a beer with your friends or two. So I was drinking Anchor Steam, and the owner came up to me and said, if you haven't ever been to the brewery, you should go, because you'd like it, Fritz. And they're closing, they're bankrupt, and they're going to close on Friday this week. You better get down there. I did right away. But he sent me down there, and indeed, I just fell in love. I mean, within a few hours, I learned that it could be purchased, the majority ownership. And I had committed to do that. I bought it for a song. They were in desperate financial trouble. But I fell in love with it, and I bought it, and then quickly realized that what was needed was not so much sales, a little money, but more care in terms of brewing. And so we went into a program where I studied brewing, I studied what we had, I figured out what we needed. So promptly the beer was better, and then gradually it became not only better, but also more traditional. They had begun taking shortcuts, the way so many breweries were doing in those days. And we went back to the most fundamental, traditional type of brewing philosophy. And so we had that combination that I call the microbrewing renaissance, which was a combination of extremely traditional attitude towards materials and process, absolute basic old-fashioned brewing with purity and simplicity, but combined with modern food processing technology and equipment. You know, the 60s weren't caused by the 60s, they were caused by ideas, and some of those were very good ideas that have always been true and always will be true. And of those, among those good ideas are to be open-minded and to value creativity and to try new things and to not be afraid and things like that. My favorite 60s story is that I lived just on the other side of the hate, as we call it, the zone where all of this stuff was wildly happening. And the brewery was on one side and my house was on the other. My family, two children and my wife, lived up on the hill just above the hate. And I had to drive through the hate every night. But I used to get hop samples that are, they're green, fluffy, leafy things. And at one point I realized we are desperate for publicity. And there'd be nothing better than getting arrested for having what would look like something green and leafy in my car and turn out to be hops. You know, false arrest, brewer is arrested for hops. In those days, there weren't any little breweries. I mean, nobody had ever heard of a guy owning a brewery, let alone driving home with hops. I put hops on this passenger seat of my car. I had a little Porsche, and I drove home with the hops on the seat for back and forth for at least a week, hoping to get arrested. Well, you couldn't get arrested in the Haight-Ashbury in those days. The whole food renaissance, I call it the food renaissance, that's taken place in America, that started primarily in California, and has spread around the world. And of course, there was borrowing from different places. The food renaissance has been a worldwide phenomenon. But it certainly has been especially an American phenomenon. I have thought about it a bit, and I think there's several reasons. One, we've had a fantastic economy. So there's been a tremendous ability for what used to be just modestly endowed people to have what they wanted. And so that's had a huge effect. I would also argue that in America, we have not just political freedom and religious freedom and economic freedom. We have what I call cultural freedom. A friend of mine says, in Italy, they eat Italian food.
in America, we eat any kind of food we want.
In the 60s and in the early 70s, I never dreamed that there would be any other little breweries like ours. I tried to persuade some of my friends who did own little family breweries in rural places to try to do what we were doing, but I was never successful. Only later, to my amazement, when some of the new little breweries sprang up, did I come to the realization that what we had done was possible for others to do. I thought we had done something so unusual, so difficult, frankly, for us, that the chances of anyone ever copying us were just zero. I certainly was disabused of that promptly. We now have 1,500, they say, 1,500 new little breweries. I heard the other day that there are 300 that are coming on stream soon, so we could have 2,000 new little breweries. It's some unbelievable phenomenon. I mean, for me, it's just absolutely mind-boggling. I decided to brew an ale just once, and it was in the early spring of 1975. And I was, at the same time, aware that the bicentennial was coming up, 1776. But I'm a guy who likes, I don't like to join the crowd. I like to get out ahead and be a little different. And so I thought, gee, it must be some way we could do a bicentennial early, ahead of the rest of the crowd. Ah, I thought, 75. Hardly a man is now alive who remembers that famous day and year and the midnight ride of Paul Revere. And I thought, that's it. And it was, maybe it was March, and I thought, April 18th. So we brewed the first brew of Liberty Ale on April 18th with the whole concept in mind. And we put on the label, brewed on the 18th of April in 75 or something like that. And I chose the name with great care and knowledge and patriotism, and I'm an exceptionalist. I think the whole American story is just unbelievable. So I thought that would be a fun name. Also, ale being, in modern times, considered to be a British specialty, I thought we would brew an ale better than anything in Britain, and we'd call it Liberty, and we'd win on all accounts. And so we did that, and the ale was terrible. I just didn't like it at all. I didn't want to sell it. I wanted to dump it. And then we brewed a Christmas ale, which was another tradition that I was very familiar with, that once upon a time, ales, beers were brewed for holidays, especially religious festivals. And that was a vital part of medieval life, to brew an ale in the village for the festival or for the wedding or for whatever. So with great delight, we brewed a Christmas ale, again, just a few hundred cases, and we gave it to our friends, and we sold some. And then we brewed Christmas ale every year for years, different every year. We didn't have capacity to brew ale regularly. But in 1983, we had moved into this brewery almost 20 years after I started. Now we had capacity. And the 1983 Christmas ale differed each year, but that year's Christmas ale was a smash success. And we suddenly thought, aha, that's it. That's Liberty Ale. We'll redo Liberty Ale. So today's Liberty Ale is exactly the brew that we made for Christmas 1983. I like to tell about what it's like out there in the trade when you're selling beer, which is hard work. And if you've ever pounded the pavement, you know what shoe leather means. And at the end of the day, when the beer salesman finds a place, a watering hole, to settle down and relax, the guy from Anchor sits down in Tommy's Tavern, and guess who's there? The guy from Sierra Nevada. And guess what they do? They have a beer together. And after about one beer, they're no longer arch enemies. They're two beer guys. And I like to think that that's part of why the whole beer trade is a brotherhood of sorts. And I also like to ask, I wonder what the shoe guys do at the end of the day. There's something about beer guys, you know, beer guys are real.